our lesson this morning. It's good to be with you this morning, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to look into God's Word together. This morning's going to be a little bit of a different lesson, so hang on to your seats there. But I think it's important. We spent the last quarter in the high school class on Wednesday nights talking about, in general, foundations for a biblical worldview. That's what I called the class. And we kind of spent the quarter looking at things that are more big picture, taking a step back, asking questions like, why do we believe in God? Why are we moral? What is justice? What is truth? What is goodness? What is beauty? Questions like that, big picture things. And that's important, I think. It's important to ground ourselves because oftentimes we can get really deep into textual study and lose sight of the big picture, or maybe we spend all our time going deeper, which is important as well, but maybe our foundation, as that class was titled, is not as strong. And so I think those kinds of discussions are important. And ultimately, that first discussion that we had revolved around believing in God. Why do we believe in God? Is it reasonable to believe in God, to have faith in God? It's kind of what we call that as Christians. And so I asked the class, what is faith? And if you ask that question in the world at large, I think a lot of people would say, well, especially in a religious context, it's just blind trust. It's blindly believing what you want to believe about God. I've heard many atheists accuse Christians of having that kind of faith, that that's all that their faith amounts to. But even some Christians I've heard say something similar to that. Faith is just believing even when we don't have the evidence or even when there's no proof, and I don't think that's biblical, honestly. The Hebrews writer, when he defines faith in chapter 11 and verse 1, he doesn't mention anything about faith being blind or being without evidence. In fact, he says that faith is assurance of things hoped for, and guess what else it is? The evidence of things not seen. So faith is not blind. At least it's not supposed to be, according to God's word. Faith is, in some sense, being assured by evidence of some reality. But here's the thing about faith in our day and age, in the time in which you and I live. Less and less people have it. At least that's my observation. I don't have anything specifically to quantify that, although I'm sure if you wanted to go look at statistics, you can find statistics to prove just about anything you want, but I'm sure you could find a statistic for that. But just from my anecdotal experience, when I was growing up, my spiritual conversations with friends at school were a matter generally of trying to talk to them about how their denominations were not true to or were not following the Bible. That was kind of what our discussions revolved around. And they had some biblical literacy. That's why we could have those conversations. Most of my friends went to church, even went to Sunday school or Bible class or something like that. And most of them knew a good bit about the Bible. In talking to Al recently, he even had a debate from the Bible with his teacher in one of his classes growing up. So I didn't quite have that, so you can kind of see the slide a little away from that point. But I had a lot of discussions with people who knew the Bible. That was kind of the norm, even as I was growing up in school. And from what I've seen and from what I've heard, that is not the case anymore, that most people know their Bible. Most people go to church. Most people are Christians in this country. That is less true from what I have seen and heard. Even in good old Alabama, you might say, well, yeah, you grew up in Alabama. This is Illinois, the Bible Belt versus the Midwest where things are a little different. Well, even in Alabama, things have changed. Things have changed. Most people not only don't know the Bible, but most people may not even really believe in the God it proclaims. I think that we're finding that increasingly common in our world. And I see enough nodding to know that that's probably been your experience as well, or at least to see that there is a drift away from that culturally. And as faith in God decreases in our society, our need to be able to reason with skeptics and reason with atheists increases at the same time. As faith in God decreases, we have an increasing need to go back to those basics and be able to talk to people who are in that kind of a place. Maybe 50 years ago, we needed to develop skills on how to talk to people in denominations most of all, and that's our evangelism. Well, less and less people are in that place, and more people are in the place of, I don't even believe in God. And so we need to figure out how to talk to those kind of people. Because we can't talk about doctrine if they don't even believe that the Bible is inspired or that this is where we can go to find doctrine. But we can't even talk about the Bible if they don't even believe that Jesus is the Word and that the Bible is God-breathed through the Spirit. We can't talk about the gospel if they don't even believe in Jesus. We can't talk about any of it if they don't even believe in a God at all. And that's kind of where our society seems to be at large, or heading towards at the very least. And so we can't talk about scripture and doctrine if people don't even believe in God in the first place. And so I want to spend our time this morning talking about why it is reasonable and logical to believe in God. Not only to bolster our own faith in God, which is important, I think, in an age where there are lots of people out there trying to convince us that we are crazy for believing in a God. But not only to do that, I also want to help us think more deeply about how we talk about God with our unbelieving neighbors and our friends and our family. And as I go through this, you might think, I don't think like this. I don't need this. Maybe not. But I can almost guarantee you someone in your family does. And so to say, well, I don't need that, so I'm not even going to bother with it, is kind of unfair to them and denies the importance of that for them. And I'll acknowledge right off the start, we're going to be in over our heads, okay? Romans 1 talks about God's divine attributes. Of course we're going to be in over our head when we're talking about God's divine attributes. Will we fully understand God's divine attributes? You can shake your head. This means no. We will not. And yet, does that mean there's no point to it being in the Bible? Does that mean Paul had no reason to write that to the Romans? That's a useless verse? Not at all. I think there's a lot of value in us being impressed with how much greater God is than us. And that's one big value of this kind of a discussion. And of course we're going to be in over our heads when we're talking about this. That's kind of the point. And it doesn't mean we don't need to talk about these things. These things are biblical and they are critical in our day and age for us to understand our God and strengthen our faith in God, even though He is grander than we can possibly put into words, imagine, or conceive of. So as we start to talk about this, perhaps one of the biggest objections that you will hear or find against the existence of God is that God can't be proven by science. You can't scientifically prove God, so I don't believe in Him. Science is much better than all that religious hogwash they had back in the day, so I don't believe in God because science can't prove Him. You hear that quite a bit. And to that I would say, here's the problem with that. Science is a good thing. I'm not anti-science at all, neither should we be. Science has done a lot of great things in our world. However, science can't account for everything. It can't. Cassie, my wife, I told her, I started to tell her I was going to stop using her as sermon illustrations and stuff, and then she just said, no, you're just always going to. So I think I'm on like a 6-week roll here, a little streak here, so we'll just keep it going. But Cassie loves me. See, this is good. Cassie loves me. I know this, I think, right? Oh, okay. All right. Very good. If you can't tell, I got this material from my mentor, Shane Scott, who would make a joke like that, certainly. Right? But Cassie loves me. I'm confident in that. I'm very confident in that. And yet, can I prove that by science? Can I apply the scientific method to that and come up with an absolute 100% certain conclusion that she loves me? No. In fact, there are times where I'm not sure I could prove that by any means, but no, not really. That's another Shane joke. You're welcome. But I can't prove that by science. Science can't account for everything. And so what I want us to see with this is that faith and science are not at war with one another. They just have different roles. There's not a big conflict there. In fact, it is belief in God. If you study history, you will find it is belief in God that gave rise to science. Science was studying the things that God had done. The early scientists were looking at God's creation and being in awe of it and saying, we want to understand this better and just see how great God is. That's how all this started. Maybe you're familiar with Psalm 19. The heavens are telling of the glory of God. And scientists are studying that. But guess what else Psalm 19 talks about? It talks about the law of the Lord. That's the psalm from which we get that hymn, the law of the Lord. It's perfect, reviving the soul. The testimonies of the Lord are sure, making wise the simple. In that psalm, there are two books of God. There's the written word, and then there's the book of creation. And scientists originally were studying that second book. They were studying God's book of nature, the book of creation. God saying, if you read this book, you will know of my glory. The heavens are telling of the glory of God. They declare it. And that's how science began. So science and faith, they're not at odds. They can actually be quite harmonious. It has to do more. The conflict comes in when someone uses science with a worldview that is incompatible with faith. And so I don't want to get into that because we could spend our entire time this morning talking about that, but some of the things we talked about in the high school class that I thought were very, very important discussions. So with that in mind, assuming that faith and science are not at war with one another, and that's kind of one of the major issues we'll hear, how can we, though, actually establish through logic and not ignoring science and not shoving all these things off to the side, and not without evidence, how do we find God? Can we find God based on reason and logic? Well, Paul gives us the outline in Romans chapter 1 of how to make the case for the existence of God. He gives it to us right here in Scripture. Read with me, beginning in verse 18. Paul says in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth." Let's stop there. What truth do they suppress? Well, let's keep reading. "For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them." They're suppressing what can be known about God. That's the truth that they're suppressing. Then we continue on to verse 20. "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." These things about God, these divine, they can be known. They are supposed to be known. This is the truth about God, and yet humans are suppressing it. Okay, how do we get an argument for God, though, from this text? Well, I want to start here. Let's define some terms, and I think you'll see how this works out. So stay with me. I'm going to get some terms defined, and then in a minute, you'll see why these are so important to this argument, okay? I'm going to ask a lot from you here, but we'll make it. The first term I want to talk about is the word contingent. A contingent thing, let's think of it like this. A real estate contract. Maybe you've heard of that. In fact, Cassie and I were looking at houses fairly recently in our past. We see a lot of houses that are contingent because, man, these things get snatched up like crazy. So what does it mean for a real estate contract to be contingent? Well, whether or not you buy the house depends on something else, some other factor. You've put an offer on it, but it's contingent. It depends on something else, namely, probably the home inspection. So you're going to put an offer, but if that home inspection comes back and says there's deadly amounts of radon in this house, okay, maybe not. Or the whole house is falling apart, or it's about to cave in, there's a sinkhole under it, who knows, something like that. But it's contingent. It depends on that home inspection coming back. So something that is contingent may or may not be. You may have a sale of that home if the home inspection comes back okay. You may not. It is dependent. It is contingent on that inspection. Make sense? All right. And here's another thing about contingent things. That which is contingent needs something else in order to be, in order to exist. Something that's contingent needs something else in order to exist. A real estate contract, go back to that example, needs a house to exist in the first place. If there's no house there, then there's no house to sell, and then there's no contract. There's no home inspection. There's no none of this. There has to be a house in place. And of course, you can go further back. Well, for there to be a house there, you got to have parts. You got to have materials. You got to have a builder. You got to have a designer, an architect. You got to have financing in place. You got to have people who are going to put those parts together. You need all those things to make that happen. And so a contingent thing needs something else or multiple other things in order to exist. And in that sense, a contingent thing borrows existence. It doesn't own it. It borrows existence from something else or from multiple other things. A contingent thing can't exist without those other things from which it borrows its existence. Okay? So you can kind of see I'm building a left-hand column here. You might get the idea there's going to be a right-hand column. You would be correct. On the other hand, let's talk about necessary things. What's the opposite of something that is contingent, that depends? Well, it would be something that is necessary. It has to be. It doesn't depend on something else. Think about a real estate contract. The buyer chooses whether or not to validate or accept the contract based on the home inspection. Right? That's how those things go. That makes it contingent. But if the buyer had to buy the house, if they had to do it, if they had no other choice, it would be necessary for them to buy it. And so something that is necessary must be. It is not contingent. It does not depend on anything. It must be. Something necessary then also doesn't depend on anything else. It just is going to be. The buyer had to buy the house. The buyer's going to buy the house. That's simply how it works. This is just logic. Maybe you're thinking, yeah, that's kind of obvious. But yeah, this is just how the logic works. So it doesn't need anything else. It is not dependent on something else. And so it doesn't borrow existence from anything else. If it does not depend on anything else, it's going to happen no matter what. It must own existence. So you kind of see we got a contrast going here. Contingent things may or may not be. Necessary things must be. Contingent things need something else in order to be. Necessary things don't need anything else. They're just going to be no matter what. Contingent things borrow existence, and necessary things own existence. They don't need anything else in order to exist. They exist on their own. So how do we put that together? Here's the case for God in four simple steps. I think it's four. It might be five. Contingent things exist. We see that pretty clearly, right? All around us. I mean, we've already talked about a house, how it needs all these things to come together. Another example of a contingent thing would be me. My parents had to come together and have a child. And in order for them to exist, their parents had to meet. And you keep going on and on. We're all contingent on, but in order for me to stand before you today, I need water and I need food and I need oxygen and I need all these things. I am contingent in many ways on many things. And many things, pretty much everything you look around, you could say that window is contingent, that wall is contingent, this lectern is contingent, this projector screen, this, you get the idea. Everything else, we can point to how it's contingent. It depends on other things in order to exist. Here's the next step. Contingent things cannot account for their own existence. If I needed some money, say I only needed $100, and so I go to a bank and I say, I need to borrow $100. And they say, okay, well, we don't actually have $100 right now. That'd be concerning, but go on with the analogy here. They say, we don't have $100, but we know another bank, so we're going to call them. And so I say, okay. So they call the other bank and they say, well, we don't have $100 either, but we know another bank, and we think they might have it, and so they call another bank, okay? And then we keep doing this ad nauseum. We call 100 banks. We get down the chain, and none of them has it. Is that going to make any difference if I call 100 more? And they're the same way. None at all. The problem is not in the number of things I can stack up, contingent things I can stack up. The problem is in the nature. If they don't have the money, I'm not going to get the money. If someone at some point does not simply own the money, I'm not going to get it. And in the same way, contingent things, things that depend on something else, you can't explain their existence with another contingent thing. And so, to use another example, me. I might say, well, how do you explain my existence? You might say, well, your parents. Okay, how about their existence? You see how this goes. At some point, someone has to own existence. And so from there, we go to the fact that contingent things cannot ultimately be accounted for by other contingent things either. I need other things. Without oxygen and parents, I wouldn't be here. And so that means that ultimately, I need something else, but those something else's are of the same nature. They can't account ultimately for my existence because they are also contingent. So, that being said, contingent things can only be accounted for by something that is necessary, something that must be, something that owns existence, something that doesn't need anything else. So, what would a necessary being be like? Let's talk about that. What would a necessary being be like? Well, the only thing that could explain the existence of contingent things would be something that doesn't depend on anything else for its existence. In other words, like we said, it must exist, because since it doesn't depend on anything, there is nothing that could change the fact that it exists. Nothing could take it out of existence or put it in. It just exists. If something must exist, for centuries, philosophers have called that kind of thing a necessary being. And unlike contingent things, like we said, the necessary being does not need to borrow its existence for anything else. It just has it. So logic's brought us to the conclusion that there must be a necessary being in addition to contingent beings, that provides those contingent beings with their existence. Okay? So we've got to the fact that we need a necessary being. Now, what is that necessary being going to be like? Well, logic, observation of creation, and intuition can help us here as well. First, if this being does not depend on anything else in order to come into existence or to exist, that means it doesn't come to be, and it doesn't pass away. It just is. Nothing can make it come into existence. Nothing can make it, just is. And what would we call that? Well, we'd call that being eternal. Nothing makes you come into existence. You don't have a start. You can't be ended. You just are. Okay, that's being eternal. Okay, so that's one characteristic of a necessary being. Next characteristic. Allow me to use another analogy about Cassie to help you understand it. I mean, it's just low-hanging fruit. Sorry, babe. But when we were about to get married in Florida, we were trying to furnish the apartment we would be living in, and not having a ton of money at that point, we bought a lot of IKEA furniture. And you save the money because you get to build it yourself, which is a lot of fun, right? It's a blast, and it's so easy, and it always goes exactly how the directions say it will go, so no. It doesn't. But that's kind of how IKEA works. So you go down to the IKEA store, you go down to the warehouse section, you know, you go through the whole showroom, and it's like a corn maze kind of thing, and you get to your products and everything. You get through that, you go to the warehouse where you actually pick up and buy a bed. It doesn't come functional, does it? It's not just a bed sitting there. You got like three boxes of weird shapes and sizes that are completely incompatible that you got to load, and it looks nothing like a bed. That's how it comes at IKEA. And so what do you have to do in order to get it into a usable form? How do you get that bed together? Well, you have to put it together. You got to assemble the parts. That's how that works, right? And that's the not fun part. But why do you have to put it together? Again, what form does it come in that would necessitate assembly? It comes in parts. It comes in pieces. It's not put together. So coming back to the necessary being, if the necessary being does not depend on anything else for its existence, that means it can't be made up of parts, because in that case, it would depend on someone to put together the parts. The parts would have to come together in some way and be put together. So, therefore, the necessary being is also immaterial, which is just a single word to mean it's not made up of parts. It can't be made up of parts. So that's two characteristics of the necessary being. Third, if something depends on nothing for its existence, that is, it depends on nothing to be what it is, then there can't be anything that would make it better or worse. Does that make sense? If something depends on absolutely nothing, if there is no contingency in it, then nothing can make it better. Nothing can make it worse because it doesn't depend. There's no contingency. If this happened, then it would be better. There's no contingency. It just is. So you can't make it better, you can't make it worse. It's just always going to be what it is. And so we can deduce that the necessary being must also be, in that sense, already perfect, or already everything it's ever going to be, fully actualized, and therefore, it would be unchanging. And the fancy term for that is immutable. But unchanging is the idea. It's the idea that the necessary being cannot get any better because it's just not contingent. There is no if this, then it'll be better, because there is no if this, then that with it. There's no contingency. All right, one more characteristic of the necessary being that we can clearly deduce from reason and observation. This is material I've had for a while, and I'm realizing I just used Cassie as an illustration for like every point, so I feel like I'm gonna need to get her like ice cream or something for lunch after this. But how can you tell the difference between me and my wife? What are some ways that you could tell the difference? Well, one way would be in our age. She is a different age than me. And I am another age, okay? Cassie can play the violin. Maybe you didn't know that about her. I can't play the violin. I play some other instruments. I play the drums. Cassie doesn't play the drums. And of course, Shane at this point would use me as a differentiator and ask how we could tell the difference between the two of us. And he had me come and stand beside him in the pulpit. If you know Shane, you know, he said we make the perfect 10. I'm the 1 and he's the 0. But anyway, but his favorite part of that was to say that I can play the violin. Jackson can play the drums. Well, anybody can play the drums, but anyway, a little self-deprecating. But with Cassie and me, she plays the violin, I play the drums. So you can tell the difference between us with age and abilities, and then also with our parts. Her hair is long. She has long hair, I have shorter hair. You can tell the difference between us immediately, even between our gender, because of the way that we do our hair, right? And there are plenty of other parts that God made us differently, all of us differently, that we can tell the difference of us by our parts. My eyes don't look like all of your eyes. My skin doesn't look like all of your skin. My hair, etc. Get the point. But if something is eternal, it has no age, and if something is already perfect and it can't develop any new abilities, it has all abilities, it's not made up of any parts, so you can't tell the difference between it by the parts, that thing would be indistinguishable. If there were multiples of them, you couldn't tell any difference. There's no age. There's no differing abilities. There's no different parts. So the necessary being, finally, must also be singular. There can only be one because you couldn't tell the difference between multiples of them if there were multiples. So you're all remarkably awake. So thank you. We've made it through the worst of the logic. Now, there remains a question. Who would we call the eternal, immaterial, unchanging, singular being who is the source of existence for all contingent reality? You can speak at this point. You can speak louder. Yes, God. Excellent. Very good. Very good. Yes, God is the necessary being. And maybe some of that got you lost, and that's okay. Like I said, guess what? We're in over our head. It's the divine attributes of God, an eternal, unchanging, immaterial, singular God. Of course we're in over our heads, right? But that's okay. Either way, the point we have arrived at is this. God must exist, and he must be these things, eternal, immutable, unchanging, immaterial, and singular. And the beautiful thing is that when it comes to the necessary being that we get to from logic, the God of the Bible satisfies every single characteristic of that necessary being. God is all of that. Remember Romans chapter 1, verses 19 and 20? Let's go back to the text. Beginning in verse 19, "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." So, we see a lot of God's attributes there. He's eternal. It's even the first thing we see about the necessary being. But with our remaining time this morning, I'm going to talk about that and some of the other characteristics of God that fulfill everything the necessary being should be by logic. I want to talk about how God fulfills these characteristics, but not only does he fulfill these characteristics, I also want to talk about what that means for us and how it impacts us as those who have been made by such a being who is so transcendent to all of us. Okay, so the first thing that I want to talk about is that first attribute. God is eternal. We've seen how God must be eternal from logic. In fact, that's one of the things that Romans 1 tells us, that his power, his potency, his ability to be who he is, his ability to do what he does is eternal. In Isaiah chapter 40, you don't have to turn there if you don't want to go through this fairly quick, but Isaiah chapter 40 is a turning point in the book. Maybe you've heard that the book of Isaiah is divided kind of like the Bible is. There's 39 chapters of the first part, just like there's 39 books of the Bible. And that's kind of the depressing part. And then the last 27 chapters, like the last 27 books in the Bible, are more upbeat. That's not to say that the Old Testament is all doom and gloom, but there's the division for you there. So chapter 40 is the first chapter of that second section where there's hope. It's a turning point in the book. And what Isaiah tells us is, guess what's the hope? Guess who's the hope? More accurately, God is the hope. God's the hope. It's God himself who's the hope of Israel and the hope of people. And so you might ask the question, well, why can Israel hope in God? Why can Israel trust in God? Well, verses 18 through 20 of Isaiah 40 emphasize that God's not like anything else. God's not like idols. God's not like anyone else. He is alone. He is singular. That's one of those characteristics we looked at. But the climax of that chapter is what I want to focus on. Verses 28 through 31 paint an incredibly beautiful picture of why we can hope in God, why we would have faith in God. Isaiah chapter 40, beginning in verse 28. Have you not known? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. He does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. He gives power to the faint. And to him who has no might, he increases strength. Even youths shall faint and be weary, and young men shall fall exhausted, but they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. There's a lot of what we just talked about in that text. Did you pick up on it? First of all, what we learn in the very first verse is that God is everlasting. What's the other word for that? It's eternal, right? And we're also told God doesn't get tired. God doesn't depend on sleep. He's not going to get older. He's not going to slow down. If you ask anyone over 50 probably in this assembly, do you feel like you did when you were 25? The answer will be resoundingly, no, I do not feel like I did when I was 25. God's not that way. He doesn't slow down. He doesn't begin to wear out. He doesn't depend on anything. He's always going to be what he is. That's what this text tells us. But what does that mean for the people of God? Let's make this practical. What does it mean for us? Verse 29 and following contain the answer to that. Because God is eternal, we can always, always, always depend on God and depend on his power. He does not faint. That's what verse 28 tells us. But verse 29 tells us we do. We do faint. Even youths, even people who are 25 years old and in the prime of their life, maybe I guess I just realized that's kind of me, and I don't necessarily feel like I'm in the prime of my life, but maybe I am. But even we faint. I'm pretty tired right now, actually. But God doesn't. In verse 28, God does not faint or grow weary. His understanding is unsearchable. We faint, but the promise he gives us is that as his people, those who wait on him, those who trust in him, we will not faint. And that's verse 31. So you see, we see all these incredible divine attributes of God in this text. But we also see what it means for us. If we have a God like this, which we believe that we do, and I think it is logical, it is reasonable, and it is sound to believe in God, look what incredible promises he's made to us. God's eternal, and that is incredibly encouraging. But another thing that I want to talk about real quick is the idea that God's unchanging or immutable. It's another characteristic of God that we derived from logic and observation of creation. And if God doesn't depend on anything to make him what he is, nothing can make him better or worse. That's where we got that idea. But that doesn't mean he's less than us, that, oh, we can grow and get even better, but God's stuck where he is. That's not the idea at all. In fact, it's kind of the opposite. God is greater than we will ever be, Isaiah 40 tells us. God's perfect. He doesn't need to be better because he is everything he ought to be. And we see that in Acts chapter 17. You'll hear me refer to that a lot. That's one of my favorite texts. Acts 17 verses 24 and 25. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by man, nor is he served by human hands. Here's the key. As though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mankind life and breath and everything. You see why I like that text? That is describing a necessary being. He has existence, he has breath, he has life, he has it all. We receive it from him. We depend on him. And scripture again emphasizes here that God needs nothing to make him what he is. In fact, he gives to all contingent reality its existence. So knowing this truth about God, that he truly is unchanging, he's immutable, he's superior to us in this way, what do we do with that knowledge? Let's hop to Exodus chapter 3. Exodus chapter 3, beginning in verse 13. Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' What shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" The very name of God is, I am what I am, or I am who I am. Anyone have a footnote in your Bible on that name that God gives for himself? Mine says, I am what I am, or I will be what I will be. And that helps us to see even more clearly a point that exists no matter what interpretation of the name you consider, that God's very name tells us something really important about him. That is, he is unchanging. I am who I am. I will be what I will be. That is our God. That's what Exodus chapter 3 says. So that's great. We can see the God of the Bible keeps satisfying all these logical characteristics of the necessary being. Everything a necessary being should be, God is. Okay, great. But again, the next question I want to pose is, what does that mean? Why is that important? How does it affect us? What are we supposed to do with that knowledge? I think we can answer that question by looking at what it meant for the Israelites when God told them this. Let's keep reading in Exodus chapter 3, verses 15 through 17. It's a little small. Hopefully you can read that. God also said to Moses, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and thus I am to be remembered throughout all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob has appeared to me, saying, I have observed you in what has been done to you in Egypt, and I promise that I will bring you up out of the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, a land flowing with milk and honey.'" So what were the Israelites told about God after being told what his name was? They're told he's going to keep his promises. That's what you need to know about God. And one of the promises God made in Genesis 12 that we talked about in class this morning was that he would give Israel a land. And here he is showing that he has not forgotten, that he is actively working to fulfill the promise he made, and ultimately, God is faithful. God is faithful. And that's the primary thing we can take away from God's unchanging nature. He's faithful. Another one of my favorite texts. "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change." Heard it once, you'll hear it again from me. But just as the Israelites could trust God to keep his promises to them, we can trust God to be faithful and do the same for us. He was faithful then, and guess what? We've been talking about this whole time. He's eternal and he's unchanging. So if he was faithful then, guess what? He's going to be faithful now, and he's going to be faithful forever. He will always be there for us. I've heard people say that to their kids, but that's not true. But with God and his children, it is. He'll never leave us. He's always faithful. And as James says, he continues to give us all the good and perfect gifts that we have, the greatest of which is a relationship with himself through his son, Jesus Christ. So maybe some of this went over your head. That's okay, because guess what? Some of this went over my head too. And especially the first time I heard it. It's just a lot to take in. And that's okay. My goal for this morning was not to make philosophers of all of you. It wasn't to make you all out to be little Platos living in modern society. That's not the idea. The point of all this is to just show that faith in God is reasonable and logical. It is reasonable to believe in God. And I also hope that I've gotten us thinking about how to talk about God with those who are skeptical in a way that doesn't demand that they check their brains at the door, that they check their logic and their reason at the door. That doesn't have to happen. We can have a reasonable, a logic-based discussion about the existence of God using classical arguments. But even more practical, as a Christian, I hope you've learned something this morning that has deepened your faith and shown you how great our God is. Sometimes I get wrapped up in thinking, okay, what's going to be the really practical application? Guess what? That is a practical application. Seeing how great God is and being in awe of Him, that's one of the applications we need all the time and we need to be reminded of continually. And so I hope this morning has deepened your faith to show that God is bigger. There is even more to prove God to us than we can even imagine. I hope you've seen how both creation and the Bible teach us about God's eternal and unchanging nature. But finally, even more than that, I hope you've seen how God's eternal and God's unchanging nature affects each and every one of us on a deep and personal level. It gives us confidence that He's faithful. It gives us confidence that He keeps His promises to us. If we are in Christ, He has indeed redeemed us and freed us from sin. And because of our great, eternal, and unchanging God, we can be confident that we are His and He will never leave us nor forsake us. What a great promise. What a great God. Do you have a relationship with Him this morning? If you don't, we have an opportunity. We want to help you. And we'd love to do that if you'll come forward as we stand, as we sing.